Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Jamie Lee Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quit lit authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. So I hope you've had a good week. Thank you so much for the feedback from last week's podcast. And of course, my exciting news that I promised you, I could finally announce to the world this week that I'm going to be doing a TEDx talk. It's a TEDx Ed, to be precise, which is quite a big deal. And it's in Norwich in the UK, and it's super exciting. Even though I've been a speaker for many years, and I've done lots of media coaching and obviously lots of presenting, I haven't ever been offered a TED talk before. So it is super exciting. And of course, my TED talk is going to be on the theme of sobriety and giving up the booze. And the title is Sobriety Rocks. Who knew? So I'm pleased with that. And yeah, it's really, really exciting. So if you happen to be in Norwich, book yourself a ticket. I think there's probably still some available. Or of course, you can watch it online. And as all TED Talks end up online somewhere, same with the TEDx Ed ones. So yeah, so that's my exciting bit of news. And it's been lovely for those people who've already given me their support. Thank you so much to Scott, the boy who drank too much, who was, I think, probably first to pop up on Facebook and say, well done. That's, it's really nice. It's it feels like exactly the right time to be stepping forward with all of this information. And of course, the news this week has been very interesting. The headlines: Britain is among the worst countries in the world for binge drinking. This is according to a new report by the World Health Organization. And Laura from Club Soda, you might have heard Laura, the lovely Laura, who is one of my podcast guests. In fact, I think she was my very first podcast guest ever. But Laura did a whole bunch of radio interviews today, all about this topic and explaining about the work of Club Soda and how things are changing. I mean, I think it's great that this stuff is in the press, and not all the kind of interviewers get it quite right. But I thought it was really good today, actually, because quite a few of the radio shows that Laura was on, they asked really quite sensible questions, and she was able to share the fact that although there are these really worrying statistics, actually there is also a lot of people who are drinking less now. In fact, interestingly, this report was specifically around binge drinking. So it was about, you know, drinking too much at once as opposed to necessarily drinking every day. And Laura was able to point out that fortunately things are changing. You know, the tide is turning, and some people are choosing to drink less. And of course, the choice of the alcohol-free drinks is absolutely you know, broadened, and that makes a huge difference. So yeah, I thought it was positive in the end, actually, even though the headlines were all really quite damning. I thought it was fantastic that a lot of the media outlets got Laura on there, Laura Willoughby, to speak, because she's just such a fantastic advocate for all of this. So it's been a busy, exciting week in the media world and getting the message out there. And of course, it's the last call for our event, which is Monday, 20th of May at the Jago in Dalston in London. It is our free event. We try to do them once a month, although, you know, it's a charity running this. It's My Yard, tiny little charity. So the work they do is absolutely amazing. But do come if you can, because it's going to be a really, hopefully, really fun night. It's going to be great to just meet like-minded people. It's very informal. It's fine if you want to come on your own. I had a message from someone saying, well, come on my own, a little bit scared. But you really don't need to be. We are, you know, we're very kind. We won't bite. And, you know, you will be made very welcome. And it is low-key. It's just a kind of funky venue. There'll be some soft drinks, some vegan nibbles, and a time for Q&A. And we've got such great guests. That's why I would love it. Those people who can make it, please, please make the effort, because you won't get a couple of specialists in the room like this again together. Certainly, I don't think. Elsa Frank is a hypnotherapist and author of the book Cut the Crap and Feel Amazing. She's a behavioral change specialist, and she has been helping people with addictions for years and years and years, as well as other problems. And she's got some really great practical approaches for how you can just change your mindset and change your behavioral habits and patterns. And that ties in beautifully with our other guest speaker, who is Dr. Richard Piper, the man behind Dry January, as he's sometimes known. Richard works with Alcohol Change UK, who are doing some fantastic work. And again, their conference, their upcoming conference, which I'll tell you more about later, is all about behavioural change, how we can make that lasting change around alcohol. So a couple of great guests. It's self-care for the sober curious. So you need to go onto Eventbrite, type in self-care for the sober curious, or you can type in My Yard, that's the name of the charity, and grab yourself that free ticket. So it's on Monday, and it starts around 7 p.m. Just be so great to see you there. I really hope that some of you can make it. So I just mentioned Dr. Richard Piper, and what better time than to bring you my interview with Richard. As I say, he's from Alcohol Change UK, and got a slightly different take on everything from some of the other guests I've interviewed, but really great to hear some of his insights. So enjoy the interview.
So I'm delighted that my guest is Dr. Richard Piper, known as the man behind Dry January. Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Hi, Jenny. I'm very well, thank you.
How are you? Really, really good to talk to you. Now, you're part of Alcohol Change UK, so we'll get on to talk a bit more about that charity. You are a charity, I think I'm right in saying.
We are.
And we'll obviously talk about Dry January and Sober for October and those kinds of months and what they mean to people trying to give up the booze. But I'd just love to know a little bit about your story, really, and what your kind of booze history is.
My booze history. So, absolutely. No, that's absolutely fine. I started drinking around 15. I did have little bits and bobs before that, but around that age, I would be having beers with friends in pubs. And I think probably alcohol was a very important sort of marker of adulthood. Mm. For me, my generation, I'm 47 now. Yes, this was 32 years ago. So, it was a very important part of obviously growing up, but also being seen to grow up. Where I lived, we were very into sort of real ales. We were in the Midlands, but we wanted to be identified as part of the North. So it was really important to us, like real ale, not lager. And I think there wasn't so much a wine culture in those days for young men. So it was very much a sort of beers, real ales, and I genuinely developed a taste for those, which I've got to this day, still really enjoy that taste. Got to the point, though, I think sort of particularly as parenthood hit in my early 30s, drinking at home, where I would find myself drinking every day, for months and months and months on end, possibly years on end. You can't remember the last day you didn't have a drink. And obviously, for many people who've been in that situation, what you also realise is that the quantity creeps up as well.
Yeah.
I certainly had those bad weeks where, you have more than a bottle of wine on two or three consecutive days, and you kind of this is definitely not right. Mm-hmm. But you justify it from whether it's stresses or work stresses or whatever, or as a blip. I wasn't doing that for long periods, but there were the odd week here and there. I did Dry January in 2016, as part of a weight loss kind of process. I was always a thin one in my family, but my mum and my sister were larger than me when we were growing up, so I saw myself as sort of thin or slim. But I sort of looked in the mirror one day and thought, oh my God, what's that thing? On the BMI, the body mass index, I was obese, just over into obese. But that's a horrible word, right?
Yeah, isn't it?
I didn't want to associate myself with that. Overweight sounds so much easier. So I thought, look, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go out of obese, through overweight, back into my normal. And Dry January was just a really good helper with that. The calories, keeping control of it. I did the dry month. That wasn't a problem. But went back to drinking after that. Got towards the end of that year, and I realised I'd done a brilliant job on the weight. I was so chuffed with myself. I'd lost 3 stone. I was well within my normal. I'd started jogging, so I'd get much, much better feeling. But I was still drinking a fair bit. That had crept back up again, and I was finding myself sometimes going, oh, I better have a bit less for lunch because I'm going to need that beer tonight. You know, at the time, felt completely normal. In this job, I now realise that's not a particularly functional way of thinking, you know, so not eating a proper lunch in order that you can have a drink. Did Dry January 2018 when I was in this job. So in an intervening period, I got this role here at Alcohol Change UK. I was in charge of Dry January. And never looked back from the alcohol point of view. So my first Dry January was very much about a weight. The second one was very much about the alcohol. So in 2018, I drank, I think it was 12 days out of 365. So, you know, 353, which I didn't drink, and just felt completely like I'd nailed it. And I still do. I still feel, you still get cravings and still get, sort of associational, those associational habits, you know, whether it's the hot weather or the stresses or whatever. But, definitely feel I've got control of it now and feel so much happier. Just feel completely free.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you class yourself as a mindful drinker then? Do you fit into that category?
I would say that, you know, a lot of it is about understanding who you are and why you were doing it. So all that thinking stuff around it. You know, I wouldn't see myself as someone who, I mean, I don't use the word recovery, for example. Right. I would absolutely fit the pattern for other people who would use that word. And I obviously have huge respect for other people who find that a very powerful narrative for them. But for me, I wouldn't use that narrative at all. I think I'm just now... I'm a very, very occasional drinker. I drank once in the last 6 months now, and that was an occasion when I chose to, and it wasn't that exciting.
Well, I think that's often true, isn't it? Once the kind of the scales come off, and you realise that it's, you know, the alcohol isn't, it's not the alcohol that's helping you have a good time. It's whatever else is going on. Tell us a little bit about Alcohol Change UK then, because I don't know how long you've been in your post, but obviously Dry January is a very big part of that. So tell us what kind of thing that you try to do, and then we'll go on to talk about Dry January and how it really, how the campaign works.
So Alcohol Change UK is an organisation. We're registered as a charity. I would refer to us as a social change organisation. Mm-hmm. We exist to reduce the harm from alcohol.
Yeah,
we're not anti-alcohol, and actually we feel that sort of being anti-alcohol is just really unhelpful if you want to reduce alcohol harm, because you can come across as kind of out of step, I think, with the general culture. But also, we aren't against the substance. Why would you be against the substance? We're against the harm that comes from the certain types of use of that substance. I think this is really, really important to make that distinction. And broadly speaking, we think there are 5 big changes that need to happen to society that will allow Britain to be a better place when it comes to booze. It would allow us to live in a sort of culture where we don't have drinking by default, but drinking by choice. In other words, I can't see the whole of Britain calling itself mindful drinking, but you and I know what that means. I think, you know, whether people use that term or not, that's kind of what we believe. A lot of people can be helped towards that, but that a lot of that starts with culture. A lot of that starts with the way we have expectations of each other, the shame and stigma that come from being someone with a drinking problem, and the shame and stigma that come from being someone that doesn't drink, and this weird middle zone where you're allowed to be. So really challenging that, and one of the things we see you doing as well, Janie, and we're very keen to work with many others, club soda, sober eaters, and many others to work towards that culture. The second area is what we call sort of policy change. So yeah, it's important that we're shifting our sort of narratives and that sort of stuff, the cultural side of things. But it's also important that we've got hard legislation and guidance in certain areas. We wouldn't call for a ban this, ban that kind of culture. We think that's really unhelpful in policy terms. But there are definitely some policy asks that would make a huge difference, whether it's learn licensing, pricing, or particularly marketing. So we'd like to see some changes in that area. Yeah. Third area would be treatment. We think treatment, alcohol treatment for those who really need it, we think there is no dispute that it's been massively underinvested in in the few years. And it's shocking. And the cost, the human cost, as well as actually the cost to all of us. These guys end up in A&E and they end up costing all of us even more money, as well as being essentially inhuman to not offer people support when they're asking for it because there aren't services available. So proper funding of treatment services is our third big thing. Fourthly, we would say knowledge. Alcohol is an area absolutely stuffed full. Everybody's got an opinion about alcohol, and there's nothing wrong with a bit of opinion, but knowledge and evidence-based approach gets us so much further, so much quicker. It's sometimes you'll know this, that when someone says, did you know X amount of alcohol in a bit of orange juice, it's those facts, those bits of information that do shift minds. Did you know that X percent of drinkers drink a quarter of all the booze? Did you know that? Those bits of evidence, those bits of knowledge are critical to moving the debate forward. And then the final and probably our biggest area is what we call, our focus on individual drinking behaviours. Mm. We don't work with people who are in treatment. We campaign for the funding of treatment for those organisations to do that. But our focus is those drinkers who are probably on their way to needing treatment, or maybe drinkers like me who can turn it around with a little bit of a nudge, a fair strong dose of willpower, a good collective kind of environment, so being around other people, but particularly online or in other sort of forums. It doesn't have to be sort of face-to-face groups, and can shift their own drinking with that kind of help before they need serious interventions for treatment. So that's our big focus.
Yeah.
Our approach to that is challenges, and we think challenges are such a simple and effective way to get people to try stuff out. It's experiential learning, isn't it? As opposed to being told to do something or given information, you actually experience something yourself. And that's Dry January is obviously our flagship challenge. But we're hoping to bring more challenges like that online. But that's what Dry January is. It's a challenge to help people learn how they could be different.
Yeah, absolutely. And, talking about your number one, as it were, first, let's look at alcohol in our society. I mean, we don't need to go into great detail. It's blatantly obvious, isn't it, that it's, it's so ingrained in our every bit of our culture. And interestingly, you mentioned the sort of shame and the stigma around those who are drinking too much. But there's also a shame and a stigma when you give up, bizarrely, because you are literally the odd one out. And a lot of people, I know when I first ditched the booze, I felt a huge amount of shame and I didn't even want to come out and tell anybody. So, I don't even know what my question is, really. But what have you found when you look at the role of alcohol in our culture?
So we would, I completely agree with you. I think that's a major area. And we refer to that as sober shaming. And one of our sort of campaign asks is actually aimed at everybody in the population to just watch out for that. Mm. I've done it, and I'm sure other people who don't mean to cause offence do it. We all do it. It's almost how we're programmed. It's almost a kind of running joke that's what we do. But actually, it's something we can unlearn quite quickly. And if everybody everybody out there just said, like, that's it. I'm not going to sober shame anyone again who's deciding not to drink. I'm not going to ask them 20 questions. I'm not going to ask them to justify why they're not drinking. I'm just going to stop doing that myself.
Yeah.
That would, it just in itself, would be an absolute massive shift. Mm. We could ask people to go further and call it out if you see it in others. But I think that's more challenging. But I would certainly say let's certainly, as all of us take that personal responsibility, just never to need to ask them, well, why? Yeah. Why? Yeah. I mean, you've had it, I've had it. It's crazy. It's crazy. We know there's no other drug that you have to justify not taking.
Yeah. And what about this policy change then? How closely or not are you guys able to affect any kind of change in any government policies?
Well, I think, you know, we all know that policy change is a bit hit and miss, in the sense that it's not a science. It's not as though X input leads to Y outcome, because there's lots of intervening factors. For a start, it depends who you're trying to influence, the colour of the government you're influencing, and its stance on various matters. Obviously, there is counter influence coming from alcohol industry. There's where the population is at and where the population is perceived to be at. You know, of course, a measure may make rational sense, but a government may feel, look, this isn't going to get the support of the public. And in a democracy, you know, one has to acknowledge that to a degree. Although quite a lot of that, I think, is kind of, you know, assumed knowledge. We think the public won't like this,
yeah.
As opposed to knowing that. And then, of course, there's the sheer sense that it's so essential to do this stuff with others. So we're members of the Alcohol Health Alliance. We're a member of the Alcohol Families Alliance. We work with colleagues, you know, across the field, not all of whom we agree with on everything, but on so many of these issues, there's actually a really broad consensus around a range of policy measures that would make a big difference. For example, there's something called the Alcohol Charter, which sets out a series of key policy asks. We work particularly, yeah, there's lots of ways of doing this. There's placard waving, there's gluing yourself to stuff, and I'm like anyone, I think there's always a case for really pushing government and using those sorts of tactics. But as an organization, our approach isn't that. You know, our approach is rational, reasonable, sensible, in relation to understanding that government's got a range of things it's looking to balance. It is legitimate for governments to care about the overall economy. They do care about businesses and jobs, and alcohol industry are businesses and they create jobs. And yeah, you know, it's very, very easy to just, you know, I don't know, be what we might call ideological about kind of one side or another of this. The reality is government's got an awful lot of things it's looking to balance. It's looking to balance, for example, the economy with public health. And those things can be mutually exclusive. The government's got to look after them both. So we try and be more of a kind of critical friend to government than just a sort of banner waving kind of organization. But we, behind the scenes, we speak very frankly to government, and actually, indeed, obviously, to the opposition as well. And we work we try to work very constructively.
Yeah.
And very solutions based. So look, here's the problem of alcohol harm. Here's what we know about it. Here's a range of solutions. We think these ones could fly. What do you think?
So I
think
that's our absolutely. And I mean, you must have been greatly heartened by the huge rise in alcohol-free drinks, because, you know, as you say, the government are not going to want to see a lot of the, you know, a load of the big brands failing. But actually, they've come on board, and the manufacturers have kind of seen this trend coming. And the big guys, your Heinekens and your Budweisers, as well as the artisan brands, have really embraced the fact that, you know, more people are not drinking. And so there's all these amazing products on the market. I mean, that presumably helps your case.
I mean, absolutely. I don't know about you. I think it's a game changer in some way. And
yeah.
I mean, certainly personally for me, I mean, I said years ago to my wife, oh, I wish they made this stuff without the alcohol in it.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time she was, well, if you didn't have the alcohol in it, you probably wouldn't like it as much. And to give her massive credit, she's completely taken that back and agreed that it was the beer that I wanted and that taste more than the alcohol. And being able to replace, we all know that replacing a habit is easier than just breaking a habit. So replacing one thing with something else that's just not causing that harm, for me, has been fantastic, and for many other people is. Now, I know it's not for everyone. I know for some people there's a slippery slope argument that it reminds them, or
that it's a trigger,
trigger for their other drinking. But I think it's really important, and I think it's also potentially important as well for, as you say, the culture, where you don't want to look like you're standing out. It gives you the ability to avoid those conversations while we've still got the culture we've got. You can stand in a bar with something that looks like a beer, you can get away with it. We shouldn't have to, but it's certainly helpful for that bridging period, I think, while we're waiting for culture to catch up with how it needs to be. And of course, I just think it just opens up options as well. From whether it's the kombuchas or just the whole concept of there's a whole range of new things we could be looking at here.
Yeah.
We've been drinking beers, wines and spirits since, for hundreds and hundreds of years. Maybe, a bit of innovation now feels like a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. And then, what we were talking about, treatment. I know that when we met, Richard, we had a very interesting discussion because I didn't really know what treatment, if any, was on offer. I mean, I know I've said before on the podcast, but there might be new listeners, so I'm very happy to say again that I think I'm one of literally millions of people who, a couple of years ago, whatever it was, I recognised that I was drinking too much. I knew because I was waking up at 3 a.m. So I knew something wasn't right, and yet I absolutely did not identify as an alcoholic or as anyone with a rock bottom problem, as it were. I was perfectly high functioning. Nobody else would know there was any kind of issue. But I knew there was a problem, and I literally could not think of anywhere where I could go to help. In fact, I did ask a GP her opinion, and her answer was, well, it seems to me that everything's fine, which is almost always the answer, in fact, isn't it? For most people. So that certainly didn't help me. I suppose what we're saying is we know now that there is this spectrum of drinking. There are lots of different shades of grey, from the high bottomed people like me, who are allegedly completely fine. And then people literally have got the dramatic rock bottom. And then there's all sorts of areas in between. Now, given that I, managed to get out of the GPs and was basically told to carry on having a couple of glasses a night because it wouldn't do me any harm. I mean, when is it ever two or one? But there you go. What about the people who are further down that line? What about when you really do recognise that you need treatment? As you said, when people are asking for help. So share with us what currently happens in the UK in terms of treatment. What's available if someone, rocks up to the doctor and the doctor can actually see that there is an issue here?
Okay, so I mean, this is a huge topic, and I probably can't do it justice in all its sort of detail. So this is going to be, I just want to, as a warning, almost, this is a very, very high level description of the sorts of things that are available.
Sure.
But first of all, people will know of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and many people may also have heard of Smart Recovery.
Yeah.
Both of those are self-help groups in which you work in a group with other people. Alcoholics Anonymous uses a very particular approach known as the 12-step model, which for many people revolutionizes their life and leads them through recovery. For other people, contains some elements they find difficult. The sort of spirituality elements are those that most commonly get mentioned as those that people find difficult. And Smart Recovery is something similar in sort of concept, but doesn't have some of those same spirituality elements, is less based, I suppose, on a particular faith background, and it draws more on sort of cognitive behavioral therapy and a kind of a range of contemporary psychological approaches. So that's kind of your first options, and you type those things into Google, you find your nearest meeting or structure, and you turn up. A bit scary for a lot of people, but that's one of the barriers, I think, for people, is that there's often not a soft way in. You just have to turn up, and I think one of the issues we have is that a lot of people need help getting along to treatment, and actually there's not a lot of what I call sort of pre-treatment support, so getting people there in the first place. Secondly, there's a statutory provision, and statutory provision is where health local authorities commission, usually they commission third parties, such organizations you may have heard of, like Turning Point or Add Action or Change Grow Live, or there are many others, to provide services that offer people support, often one-to-one, sometimes in group settings, and sometimes a mixture, to overcome their their addiction. And this is often in the concept of addiction therapies, will involve sort of psychological interventions. And if that individual's got physical addiction as well, may involve managed withdrawal, which is a sort of medical technique where people are helped to reduce their physical dependency safely. If you are physically dependent and you just stop drinking, that can be incredibly dangerous. It can kill you.
Yeah.
The medical withdrawal helps people sort of detoxify their system and withdraw safely. And then, of course, there's the psychological interventions, addiction support. Many of those are offered combined with drug services, and we get significant feedback that people find that challenging. I don't want to go along to somewhere where there's going to be people using illegal drugs. Although many people then go, actually, you know what? Actually, it's given me a completely new view about addiction. I've got newfound respect for people who are trying to overcome drug addiction, and I realise that my drug of choice, alcohol, is a drug. And I think a lot of people can find that powerful. And then thirdly, you've got sort of things that people, you know, residential care. Is often called rehab, and we often associate with celebrities because we read about celebrities going into rehab, and it kind of is one of those things. But actually, that is something available to everybody if they choose to do so. But that's private provision, so that's often something that you're having to pay, you know, to go through.
Yeah.
So that's a very rough guide. There's a lot more out there. There's more complexity, but the statutory provision is the one that most people rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the one that's been absolutely decimated in recent years as funding has been cut. One in six people who require treatment actually get it at the moment. So we do have a major problem.
Really? So what happens to these people then?
The people who receive treatment will commonly have a limited number of sessions. It could be 6, it could be 12, it could be 16 one-to-one sessions with an addiction counsellor, potentially with a psychologist, with an alcohol specialist. There could be a range of sort of professions involved in that individual's care, and we'll work with that individual on kind of why they drink and supporting them to think about how they could drink less. As with all forms of sort of therapy, it's about helping that individual find the answers for themselves. Mm. The success rate is very high. There's dispute, I think, about how we should measure this. A lot of measures are, you know, relate to abstinence. So you've been abstinent for 6 months. You kind of count as a success. If you've been abstinent for 5 months and then had a one or two beers, you don't count as being a success, but you may actually have learned to moderate. I know many people feel they can't moderate, but some people feel they can. So there's some dispute about what success counts as, but broadly speaking, it works.
Yeah.
You know, treatment works. People can be supported to stop drinking. It is really horrendous that it doesn't exist. And people who are not getting, it's a bit of a postcode lottery. So it depends where you are in the country, whether or not you've got support and whether or not that support is big enough to serve the population, whether it's good enough.
Yeah. And what would you like to see happen then? I mean, I know that's a massive question, but, you know, give me a suggestion of something that you would like to see change, you know, to see happen in the next, year or something.
Okay, yes. So I think government should absolutely commit to investing in alcohol treatment services to the level of need, not the level of how much cash there is lying around. We know that the alcohol industry has money to burn. It spends, I think the figures are way over £100 million. Actually, I don't know the exact figure, but it's a ridiculously high figure with millions and billions in it just spent on alcohol marketing.
Yeah.
Even just a 1% levy on the profits of the alcohol industry or the sale of the alcohol industry would generate enough money to more or less cover the entire cost of alcohol treatment in the UK. In fact, we've got a duty freeze. So alcohol duty has been frozen now for successive years. With inflation, that's a real term cut. So the alcohol industry is currently making more and more profit every year in terms of its duty. So, yet the alcohol industry acknowledges that it feels that the real problem area in terms of where it does acknowledge that there is such a thing as alcohol harm of course, it talks about drinking in pregnancy and drink driving, the two things that kind of people are broadly accept in culture. But the alcohol industry does also acknowledge that there are those who require treatment, the so-called so-called problem drinkers, a term that problematizes the drinker, of course, not the supplier of the product. But nonetheless, there is at least a consensus that that group requires support. We'd like to see the industry either voluntarily put significant amounts of money into helping those individuals recover, or if they're not prepared to do so, the government should at least introduce the duty escalator again and take 1 or 2% from that industry, either at least on inflation, if not above inflation, and that money could be ring fenced and millions of people could be helped.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that, well, I mean, we could talk forever about all the different things that could be done, but I mean, obviously, that's the name of your organisation, Alcohol Change, that it definitely does need to be changed. But that brings us to, you know, your fourth point, as it were, which is that so much actually focuses around knowledge and around education and around, well, what I would call inspiration. I think actually inspiring more people to recognise that there is life beyond alcohol is a really big one. and that was the missing piece for me. You know, I wouldn't have needed any of those services, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. So I'm hugely grateful for that. But I do know that if I hadn't have found this sober world, if you like, if I hadn't have found a community, if I hadn't have found my people or my tribe or a way of doing this with some kind of support, I would still be, you know, back where I was 2 years ago. And I think this is why the kind of work that you guys are doing is so important, because you're helping spread this knowledge. I mean, tell us some of the ways that you work within Alcohol Change to try and educate and inspire people.
So I think we see our website as just a really, really important place for people to come. You know, Drinkaware is funded by the alcohol industry. You know, it ostensibly has independence of the alcohol industry. But we just think it's really important. There's a place where people can come, a website where people can come, Alcohol Change UK, that lets people sort of have the unvarnished truth. And that means that we're also prepared to kind of say, you know, there are some benefits to drinking. And I know people find that, you know, some people who we work with can find that very challenging. Oh no, you mustn't say that because people might, you know, so, well, sorry, but it's true. You know, people experience benefits to drinking. Now, whether or not they're on medically or whether or not, you know, the J curve and the impact of low drinking being better than teetotaling for certain heart conditions and the sort of ongoing disputes and, you know, strong evidence over time around that. Certainly, the social element, experiencing a drop in inhibitions and experiencing some of those elements around finding it easier to talk to someone who you fancy, all those sorts of things. You know, we just have to kind of be a bit more grown up about this and kind of accept that. But then someone also needs to say, you know, the chief medical officer's guidelines around 14 units, where did that come from? A lot of people find that problematic. A lot of people think, no, they're brilliant, they're great. So having where do people go to get kind of a really real insight into where do those guidelines come from? What compromises were made in developing those guidelines? What are the strengths and weaknesses of those guidelines? Because all guidelines like that have strengths and weaknesses. What are the weaknesses? What are the strengths? And I think for being honest, is probably our number one kind of value, really, letting people know, because this is a topic where there's so many people who want you to think things that they want to think. For us, it's really about helping people discover what they think and what they believe. And I think that's so important to us, that people have that access to trusted information. So that's kind of one of our key activities. And I think our website and our knowledge base is all really about evidence. But then, of course, we get onto things like Dry January. And I think that, for me, Dry January is about a different form of knowledge. I mean, that might sound odd, but what I mean by that is, you know, I think I'm going to use a weird analogy here, but map reading. So I do some youth work. As a volunteer, I work with young people on map reading. And it's great sitting in a room with a map and a compass talking about bearings and degrees and going, what? Yeah, kind of, I get it. It's completely another thing going into across five fields with a map and going, see, that's a pylon. I get it. Or indeed actually putting people out on their own with a map and saying, find your way back, which is what I did with a group of kids the other day. A drop hike, you know, we dropped them off and we said, find your way back. In other words, experiential learning, that kind of knowledge, is a different form of knowledge, and for many people a much more powerful form of knowledge. So Dry January for us is an experiential learning opportunity that gives people personal knowledge, completely personalized knowledge. Okay, it's Wednesday night and it's gym. I didn't realize what a role gym was playing in holding me back. I love gym, but I'm gonna have to think about how I deal with this. You know, you don't get that from reading a book. You get that from giving it a go and learning about what your triggers are, what your weak spots are, actually what your abilities are. God, I'm so much better than I thought at saying no, I just need to do it. I've been overcomplicating it, or whatever. Everyone's journey is going to be different, and then because of that difference, because that radical difference of everybody's life and everyone's lifestyle and everyone's friendship groups, they need to have the personal experience of a dry month with a view to longer term change. I think that's the key thing, with a view to longer term change, but through that short-term experience. And then, you know, I'm fond of saying that the most important day in Dry January is the 1st of February. It's the day you wake up, and then whatever plans you made the night before about what you're going to do, that's the day you start to implement those plans. You start to reflect and you go, okay, this is where I'm at. This is who I want to be. And many people do multiple Dry Januaries before the 1st of February becomes their special 1st of February, the one that goes, that's it. I was reading a post the other day on our Facebook group. It's my fourth Dry January. It's the one where I got it.
Yeah.
And
yes, I mean,
I know what they mean. You know what they mean, and many of you listening to this will know what that means. But for people who are just having a month off booze without really thinking about it, they do kind of can miss the point.
Yeah, because obviously, I mean, it goes without saying, if the only reason you're doing it is because you think, okay, you're going to give your body a break, but then you're literally counting the days till you can start again. I mean, I would say that's where you're missing a trick, because actually, you know, there are so many benefits to be had, but some of them come a little later down the line. And actually, depending on how long you've been drinking, it can take your body more than a month to kind of recalibrate and get everything sorted. So you know, I think Dry January is a fantastic start. But as you say, to allow yourself to look towards a longer challenge is always good. I'm just conscious, I mean, I could talk to you for hours, but I'd love to just get your view on the link between alcohol and anxiety and mental health, because it's something that comes up a lot, obviously. I'd just love to know your view on that, and whether you've experienced any change yourself in I don't know whether you used to have any anxiety issues or anything like that, or whether in fact there's stories of anyone else that you might want to share, because I think this is one of the benefits that's not often talked about enough, actually.
No, I think that's a really important point. And when we talk about alcohol harm, you're very, very, very roughly, that cuts into harm to yourself and to your health, and a harm to others, for example, through violence or drink driving, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, that first category, harms to your health, it's so easy to focus on, you know, the seven types of cancer, the liver disease, the strokes, all those physical health, but mental health is absolutely one of the massive harms that results from alcohol. And I think I'm one of those people that tries to avoid answering questions with well, it's complex. But I think actually with the question around alcohol and mental health, you have to say it is complex. We know that there is a relationship between mental health and drinking too much, which sort of works in both directions. So we know that not feeling brilliant, having anxiety, for example, having social anxiety, can lead to people wanting to drink more. I can't go out. I can't go out. I can't go out. I have a drink at home. I have a drink with someone else. I'm out. I'm chatting. This is good. I can suddenly socialize. And I can remember being at university and kind of thinking it's just so much easier when I'm having a drink. I've never been someone who personally has suffered. I'm very lucky to date not to have suffered with mental health problems. But a lot of people particularly we use our Facebook groups. Dry January is very much about supported collective community. As you've mentioned before, the inspiration support we get from being with others is critical to Dry January. And our Facebook groups, you know, mental health is one of the most talked about topics. So that very common experience of being shy or awkward and all the things we are when we're 15, 16 and 17. Yeah, we're meant to be, right? That probably comes with the territory at that age. But alcohol being a sort of lubricant in that way and actually then starts to take over. But obviously we know it works the other way. Having an alcohol problem is itself a mental health problem for many people. The vast majority of people with alcohol dependency have mild or moderate or severe psychological dependency. It's primarily a psychological dependency as opposed to a physical dependency. That physical withdrawal is a relatively small group, but there's huge numbers of people, we're talking in the millions, who will experience a mild or moderate psychological dependency, or you can call it a habit if you want to kind of use lay language, have a bad drinking habit, essentially. That is itself a mental health problem. And you and I, Janie, will know from our experience that, you know, that it just, it's these triggers, it's these associations, it's this inability to say, you know, to do what you said you were going to do. I'm not going to drink tonight. And you do. And it's those kind of things tell us that people have got a mental health problem.
Yeah.
There are clearly links between, common, but complex links between alcohol and depression as well. Alcohol obviously is a depressant, many people on our group certainly report that, and there's some of the things I've been reading, and this is anecdotal, but in large numbers, I'm talking, you know, hundreds of people saying these sorts of things out of groups of around 2,000 or 3,000, I suddenly have a much starker view of my life without the alcohol fuzz. And I'm having to start dealing with things I've not had to deal with. Mm. And I think it's important for people to kind of appreciate that, you know, you can live your life in a bit of an alcohol-induced fug and can avoid many of those things. But the vast majority of those people, if not all of them, end up saying, but I'd never go back. And I am so much happier starting to actually deal with these issues sober. I'm actually dealing with these issues as someone who's focused and clear and thinking and actually working through these issues that actually I've just been avoiding. So I think alcohol also plays a role in not addressing mental health. So that's the third element.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely so true. And you know, we've said a lot of times as well that, of course, giving up alcohol doesn't instantly make all your anxiety go away or cure your mental health issues. But it sure as heck will enable you to face what's really going on, and it won't exacerbate the situation further. Just one more question then, Richard. And there are people who say, look, these challenges like dry January, dry July in the States, you know, sober in October, these kinds of things that are much talked about in the press really are a waste of time, because actually you can do yourself more damage if you just give up for a month. What's your take on that? What's your experience of that?
So firstly, there's no evidence at all that giving up for a month creates more damage than not giving up for a month. What we know is that, you know, my background, this might be very dull to your listeners, but I'll keep this very brief. My background is on impact assessment and understanding whether an intervention, whether it's a charity's intervention or a government intervention, is successful or not. So there is absolutely no way I would have programs within my organization that weren't effective. And we hold ourselves very strongly to account, particularly around Dry January. Mm-hmm. Does it work for people? Does it make a difference for people? And we are very active at assessing that and asking ourselves the counterfactuals. Are you sure we haven't got our biases on here? Because it's a project we're running. I am utterly convinced that Dry January is an effective campaign if it's run properly. If it's run as a fundraising campaign, which it's not. It's not a fundraising campaign. It's a behavior change campaign. If it's run as a behavior change, I worry about that. I worry a little bit about Sober for October, which is primarily a fundraising campaign. And also, there are other campaigns run out there, because they're saying the message, you know, when people fundraise in other formats, you know, whether it's jump out of the plane or run a marathon or have a bath in baked beans, you're saying, well, I'm going to do something a bit rubbish, a bit tough, a bit not very nice. Mm. But in return, you give me money and we'll give it to this charity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think that's completely the wrong message, because I don't see Dry January as giving something up. I see it as gaining something.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to do something brilliant. Why would you want... It's a bit like saying, look, I'm going to the fairground tonight. Will you fundraise? Will you give me some money? Because it's, you know... No, you're going to have some fun. Why? You know, what? It doesn't make sense. So I think we need to cast Dry January as a behaviour change campaign. Yeah. Secondly, we have to absolutely use it, pitch it as being an experiential learning. It's a short-term experience for long-term change. And I think we can't hammer that message home enough. And the reality is, actually, that's what most people use it for. It's, I think, a bit of a media myth that people get back on the wagon whatever they're doing on the 1st of February, going back to hammering it. That's a bit, that's a small group of people do that. But the vast majority of people who are giving up alcohol for a month are doing so because they've probably got pretty good reasons for doing it. Why on earth would they do it just to have a month off? There is a small group that do that, but it's a really small group. Mm. And finally, our evaluation tells us that 76% of people who do Dry January are drinking less 6 months later.
Yeah.
So it has a long-term effect. And my obsession is to grow that figure. So they're not just drinking less, but they're drinking much less. And they kind of, as you say, the scales have come off and they've seen a new life, a new opportunity for them, whether they've chosen to take that or not. They've seen that new life, that new community that they could have. And that figure is absolutely as high as it could be. But so done well, campaigns like this work. Done badly, of course, they're not going to be as effective.
Yeah, yeah. Finally, tell us about the conference that Alcohol Change UK are running in London.
So on Wednesday, the 19th of June, we're looking to bring together so many different voices who want to come together and discuss reducing alcohol harm in our society. It's open to members of the public. It's open to academics. It's open to policymakers. It's open to those working in the treatment field. We think it's so important that what can be a group of people who can each talk to their own tribe, to use your word from earlier, actually come together and talk to each other. We think people have got a lot more in common than they often think they have. Mm. GPs and alcohol treatment workers don't often talk to each other, and alcohol treatment workers don't often talk to opposition ministers. And opposition ministers don't spend a lot of time talking all the time. Some of them do, but a lot of them won't spend a lot of time talking to those who are working on the cultural side of movements, like yourself, who will be there, hopefully. Mm. Janie, I know you're helping us out on the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it, yeah.
Laura from Club Soda, you know, I think it's important that you guys are continuing to be heard by others. So I think for us, just a really exciting day. We're looking at loads of brilliant topics. We've got a beginning workshop about anarchy in the UK. Why is Scotland and Wales doing things differently, and Ireland actually from England, and what's going on there? What's the reason? Why do we have these differences? We've got some really, really interesting stuff on the brain, the latest thinking in terms of neuroscience and change. We've got a really inspiring wrap-up speech at the end from Africa Brooke, who some of your listeners will know, talking really about sort of empowerment, which for us is such an important topic here. Mm. And we've got some parallel workshops covering innovation. Where are we going next on treatment? Where are we going next on alcohol marketing? And where are we going next on kind of a range of issues? So should be a brilliant day. It'd be great to see people there. There's a really low rate for sort of members of the public. So those who maybe don't have a professional interest but have a personal interest in this area, do not be fazed. Come along.
Great. So give us your website then, and where people can find out more about the conference and tickets.
alcoholchange.org.uk. Have a look through there.
We should say, by the way, you do have some lovely blogs. I mean, you very kindly asked me to write something for you, and I'm in very good company. You've got some great people writing there, and I think it's some great voices on there, really, and it's a whole range of stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. So come and play with our website for a bit. Have a look at our blogs. We've even got some 5 jobs going available if anyone's interested in working for us, opportunities to fundraise for us, but also information about our conference. We've got a quiz, a tool. We've got a range of new content. We've got something very exciting coming out in November, which we're looking forward to launching. So, yeah, it's a good place to be.
Excellent stuff. Richard, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be on your podcast.
Thank you.
So just to recap again, the conference is Wednesday 19th. It's 10 to 5. It's being held in Regent's Park in London, and it's going to look at the evidence of on alcohol use and the and harm across the UK, and also at the policies that have the potential to drive the change. And they are going to be discussing what's happening on the what's happening with the treatment sectors, how cultural norms can be shifted. They'll be hearing from people affected by alcohol harm, and there'll be presentations and panel debates and workshops. And, you know, at first I thought maybe it's only for health professionals, but that's not the case. You know, it really, they really are welcoming anyone who wants to learn about the benefits and the pitfalls of what's going on at the moment in the UK around policymaking around alcohol. Anyone who's interested in the challenges for public health, anyone who's interested in new and innovative ways to look at alcohol and the range of programs that are available. And, you know, great if you're a student, a researcher, a healthcare professional, if you're in the voluntary sector, if you're just interested in this topic in alcohol harm reduction. I think it's going to be a really powerful day. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to be hosting some of the afternoon sessions, so it would be great to meet some of you there. So it's the Alcohol Change UK Conference, Wednesday 19th of June. So yet another reminder, Monday 20th of May, that's next Monday, our event, Self-Care for the Sober Curious. It's free. Go to Eventbrite and grab your tickets. It's all done with the charity My Yard. And our guests again, Richard, who you've just heard, and Elsa Frank, behavioural change specialist. And what's my self-care tip? Well, I've been thinking about this and, you know, I don't know quite where this train of thought has come from, but on the podcast, I've spoken a fair bit, and I've had a few guests who've spoken about kindness and the importance of kindness. In fact, we interviewed Sharu Zadi, as you know, who's written a great book on kindness, and also Dr. David Hamilton. And we've just spoken about what an impact kindness can have, not just on the recipient, but on the person giving the kindness, as it were. And a couple of things have happened to me recently that got me thinking. One was that I met a woman who is a successful businesswoman, but lives a relatively frugal life, and made a decision some years ago to give away 50% of her income on a monthly basis. So not necessarily always to the same people either, or the same charities. And it's really interesting, just such a fascinating conversation we had, where she was saying that, you know, it, in a funny sort of way, it's not completely altruistic, because she genuinely believes that it was actually a fantastic business decision, because she's convinced that her business keeps on growing and growing and growing because of what she gives. And of course, it's not without its benefits in other ways, because she is able to help so many people and they benefit so massively, you know, from her generosity. So that really struck me when I heard about that recently. And then the other thing that happened just a couple of days ago was I've interviewed Mary Portis, Queen of Shops, I used to call her. Mary Portis, for anyone who doesn't know, is very famous in the UK, really inspirational woman who's done a lot for kind of fashion and enterprise and how the high streets are looking. She's a TV presenter and a writer. And she was in at BBC Radio 2, and I wasn't interviewing her on this occasion, but we have met before. But she was on a programme where she was discussing what it means to be human. And she started off her kind of explanation of her background by describing that her parents died when she and her brother were very young, something like 19 and 15, something like that, teenagers. And she was saying that they only survived and thrived, certainly they only thrived, because of the kindness of some neighbours who had their own four kids and a lot going on and could really have probably done without another two teenagers, but they took them in. And she talks about how all these years on, that profound act of kindness made such a massive impact on the person that she is. And I said to her afterwards, you know, it really has impacted on you, I know, because I know personally, because a few years ago, Mary had come in to be interviewed on our show, and she'd walked in and she was wearing this incredible, unusual statement kind of necklace, this really unusual gold parrot kind of bit of costume jewelry. And I said, oh my goodness, I love that. I just absolutely love it. You know, where did you get it from? And she said, oh, I'll write down the name of the designer for you. So she grabbed a piece of paper and she was writing down the name of the designer. And then she just looked at me and she said, I tell you what, I can always get another one. Why don't you have mine? And then she insisted on placing this amazing necklace around my neck. And I've never forgotten it. Well, of course I haven't. There are lots of pictures of me wearing this incredible necklace. And wherever I went, people would always comment on it. And of course, I would always tell them that Mary Portis gave it to me. An amazing act of kindness. So anyway, that's a really, really long-winded way of saying my self-care tip for this week is to challenge you to offer someone an act of kindness, whether someone you know or anonymously. And it doesn't have to be anything big. You don't have to give away your income. You don't have to give away your favourite necklace. It might be paying for a coffee for someone in the queue behind you, or taking a magazine or a newspaper to someone who you know doesn't get out to the shops, or just smiling at somebody or sending them an email, whatever it is. But that's your little self-care tip. And I think, as I've definitely said before on the podcast, I know I said this to David Hamilton, I really think that particularly if things aren't so fantastic for you right now, perhaps if you are actually struggling a bit, this can be actually the best thing you could possibly do for yourself. Because there's no doubt about it, when you actually focus on other people, it definitely makes you feel better. So feel free to let me know what you do, big or small. You can use the hashtag #StayDry till July. We've still got that going on. We've still got some great prizes to give away as well. I must remember to launch another one soon. But we just want to get our events publicised first. So Monday, 20th of May, I do look forward to seeing some of you there. And coming up on the podcast, by the way, I've got some really interesting guests. I'm kind of getting a few stacked up now, so we're getting lots of guests. But I still will say, do let me know if there's anyone that you would like me to try and interview. I can only pitch out. I'm super excited that I'm going to be interviewing Mrs. D, Lottie, from Mrs. D is Going Without. It was one of my favourite books when I first gave up. And then I also read Mrs. D is Going Within. So we're going to jack up that interview. It's not going to be easy because she's in Australia, of course. So her nighttime will be my day, but I'm sure we'll manage to make it work. I've also got a great interview to bring you with a sports broadcaster in the UK, and also a musician. So lots of interesting, amazing guests coming up. And also, I haven't forgotten that I've got a few listeners who are going to come on and share their story as well. So we're looking forward to that. Thank you so much for listening. Stay strong, and see some of you on Monday. And for the rest of you, I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Jamie Lee Grace. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us, share on social media, and tune in again.